Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Parker, a blizzard is blanketing the Midwest, downing power lines, canceling flights, and potentially disrupting an opening chapter in the presidential campaign. Here's CBS forecaster David Parkinson.
It is going to be the coldest Iowa caucus on record, and it's not even close. The previous record coldest was back in 2004 when it was 16 degrees for a high. We'll probably only get to -4 on Monday.
Iowans are made of tough stuff. Hope football fans in Kansas City are too, ahead of today's wild card playoff game between the Chiefs and the Miami Dolphins. Forecaster Parkinson again.
That's probably going to be the coldest playoff football game potentially on record. Your high temperature for the day is 6 degrees. When you're kicking off, it's probably closer to 0 degrees, and your wind chill probably below -20.
The Chiefs coach says his team's prepared.
KC coach Andy Reid.
Cold is cold, but you go do your thing, you go play. There's one thing you don't have to do, and that's to tell them stand by the warmers.
Stand by the warmers. There will be a lot of that.
CBS's Steve Kathan. After a tight presidential race on the island of Taiwan.
Taiwan's electorate has rejected two presidential candidates offering to build closer relations with China and instead voted to keep the center-left progressives in power. The next president will be its current vice president, 64-year-old William Lai. Vilified by Beijing, Lai pledged to protect Taiwan from Chinese threats and intimidation. Lucy Kraft, CBS News, Tokyo.
And Chinese President Xi Jinping has just repeated China's claim that Taiwan belongs to China. The U.S. has hit more sites in Yemen linked to the Houthi rebels who've been attacking Western shipping in the Red Sea. Pentagon spokesman Major General Patrick Ryder.
We absolutely do not want to see extension of the conflict in Gaza broader into the region, and we'll continue to work hard on that. But at the same time, we can't allow the Houthis to continue to conduct these attacks, putting innocent mariners' lives at risk and affecting the global economy.
About 12% of world trade passes through the Red Sea. Boeing MAX 9 jets still grounded after last week's mid-air incident when that door blew off an Alaska Airlines jetliner. CBS's Jennifer Kuiper has more.
President Zelensky.
United and Alaska Airlines say they have canceled Boeing 737 MAX 9 flights through Tuesday. Alaska has been canceling about 20% of daily flights since the grounding of its 65 MAX 9 planes.
And a Boeing 737 on a domestic flight in Japan had to return to its departure airport earlier today after an outer cockpit window cracked. All Nippon Airlines says none of the 66 people on board was injured. The incident did not affect cabin pressure, and the aircraft involved was not a MAX 9 jet. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin is one of the leading states for vehicle crashes with wildlife. Mike Moan reports now on some ideas to make roads safer.
The National Wildlife Federation says there are more than 1 million such collisions in the U.S. each year, resulting in injuries and deaths to animals, drivers, and passengers. And costs associated with these accidents range between $8 and $11 billion annually. The Federation's Jeremy Romero says another impact tied to all this is the ecological effect.
Roads, fences, development, things like that are all types of fragmentation that decrease connectivity for wildlife to be able to move across the landscapes.
Romero fears the situation could worsen with projections showing higher traffic volumes in the coming years. He points to good news, though, with the federal government rolling out a new $350 million pilot program. States can apply for grants to pursue safe wildlife crossing infrastructure. A 2021 investigative report found Wisconsin has many crossings for smaller animals, but not deer. State officials contend these projects aren't as effective for species in this region. Still, Romero encourages all states to beef up research and look at ways to reduce these collisions. He says drivers can do their part, too.
If you're in an area where you know there's a lot of wildlife, the best thing and the most immediate step you can take to prevent wildlife vehicle collisions is to slow down.
Other tips include keeping an eye out for animal crossing signs and to flicker your high beams when approaching wildlife in hopes of causing the animal to scurry away. The peak time of year for deer collisions is October through December during hunting and mating seasons, but DNR officials say there can be an uptick in late spring when fawning happens. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bauer.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, snow and blowing snow. Winds continue to gust 30 to 35 out of the northwest. Temperatures fall throughout the day. Tonight, cloudy skies, single digits, wind chills down to 15 below zero. For Sunday, cloudy and cold, staying below zero with those wind chills.
It's 21 right now.
Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
And we are back on this, our 80th broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, our Saturday morning show focusing on significant events, circumstances, developments in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. This is our 80th broadcast, and I thank you, as always, for listening in every Saturday morning or every Saturday morning that you are able to listen in on, every Saturday morning, if possible, when we talk about these important issues for our world, for our nation, and our state as well. As always, supported in my studio here in Waukesha by my wonderful producer, Anya, who together with me is presenting our program this morning and every Saturday morning. In our first hour this morning, spent a lot of time talking about international rule of law matters, some undiscovered justice out there, not because it's completely undiscovered, but because it has not been the focus of a lot of our national media. Things coming out of Israel and Chile and Suriname and The Hague, all of them underscoring the importance of things like a judiciary that is responsible for providing a check and a balance to the executive branch and the parliament. The importance of a constitution, that is a constitution that's embraced by the people of a nation, or in the case of Chile, rejected a couple of times in the population's attempt to identify a new governing document for its nation. In Suriname, the notion that even the most highly placed individuals, people in the executive branch, the president there, are not above the law and are responsible for the things that they do in office. The president, the former president there, reporting to prison in Suriname this coming week, having been previously convicted, his appeals having been basically rejected there in that nation, now responsible for showing up in prison and serving his prison time for the things that he did while he was in the position of president, the chief executive of that nation, and at The Hague. The importance of the rule of law in a courtroom, this time brought by two nations, South Africa and defended by Israel, having to do with the Hamas-Israel war right now going on. All of that underscoring for us the importance of the mechanisms by which we establish basic standards and processes for government in republics where the people are the ones served by government And the people have a right to expect not only balances of power, checks and balances, but also the supremacy of the rule of law over and above any single individual, over and above any single institution, all of that in service to the people who ultimately give power and force to the government itself. From Israel, from Chile, from Suriname, and yes, from The Hague in the Netherlands, lots of things from the past several weeks to take notice of as we move back now to our own nation, the United States of America, and take some inventory of some of the cases going on in the courtrooms of our own nation. Let's begin. Let's begin in New York, as we often have. This past week, Judge Arthur Engoron, who is the state court judge, actually called justices there in the state of New York, presiding over the trial. You may recall, well, this is the civil trial. It's not a criminal trial. A civil trial, a civil complaint brought by the Attorney General of the state of New York, her name is Letitia James, seeking now $370 million against the Trump Organization, and also, perhaps even more significantly, seeking to stop the Trump Organization from being effectively incorporated in New York, being able to operate not only real estate, but also other things, the other trappings of the Trump Organization for years and years and years, basically barring him and the company from serving in an official capacity under the rules and regulations of the state of New York. The basis for that lawsuit, which again has now concluded in the wake of oral arguments of the past couple of days, now before the judge, determining what kinds of remedies will be imposed by the court upon Donald Trump, his sons, and the corporation. You may recall well that Justice Judge Engoron, previously, even before the evidentiary portion of the trial began, he had determined on what's called a motion for a summary judgment, had entered an order finding that fraud had existed. And the trial that was conducted in the wake of that pretrial determination was basically to flesh out some additional counts in the civil complaint brought by the Attorney General, but again, mostly to determine what, if anything, should happen in the wake of that finding of fraud inside the Trump Organization. And so, this past week, specifically Thursday and Friday, the defense, on behalf of the former president, had an opportunity to present its case, to argue as the defense did, that the prosecution, the state, had not met its burden. And interestingly, along the way, a significant procedural matter happened. There was a proposal by the defense right before the oral arguments began for Donald Trump himself to deliver the closing argument on his own behalf. Now, in normal circumstances, in a civil case, certainly in a criminal case, it goes one way or the other. If you are represented in court, you speak through your attorney. If you are not represented and you're representing yourself, then you speak on your own behalf. In this case, the judge, again giving Donald Trump an awful lot of latitude, as he has during the course of this trial, said that I will permit Donald Trump to speak in court as long as what he says is not testimony, as long as this is not a campaign speech, as long as he does not attack, as he has publicly, the judicial officers, the law clerks, the attorneys general, the other people involved in the prosecution of this case, as long as he does not turn this into anything other than a summary of his perspective on what the trial showed. And in the end, the defense, the Donald Trump team, rejected that because, according to their own statements, they could not abide by those very legitimate impositions, those restrictions, if you will, imposed legitimately by the judge with respect to anything that Donald Trump may say. Now, what happened in the end was, even as counsel for Donald Trump was making the case that the case should be dismissed, the government had failed to meet its burden of showing the extent of the $370 million fraud, showing the entitlement to stop the Trump Organization from going ahead. During the course of that, counsel once again asked Judge Engoron if their client could speak. And Judge Engoron basically reversed himself and said, well, all right, I will permit Donald Trump to speak briefly. He said, I'll give you 5 minutes. And sure enough, during the course of that presentation, as Judge or Justice Engoron predicted, Donald Trump, while refuting some of the basic core allegations, some of the portions of what he said may have arguably been in the category of a legitimate closing argument. Most of it was an attack upon the legitimacy of the process, arguing this was political in nature, the kinds of things that he has said in the public domain, which he said, frankly, right before and right after the oral arguments themselves, attacked the court itself that's going to be deciding on the very merits of the case that it presently has before it. It was precisely what Judge Engoron had predicted. The case came to an end based upon that defense presentation. Donald Trump, quite literally, given his day in court in a way that no other civil or criminal defendant would be afforded in the courts of America, given this special opportunity. And Friday, of course, the prosecution, the state of New York, once again summarizing all of the evidence. You may recall that in the initial complaint, Letitia James was seeking $250 million. She sought $370 million in the end. Why? Because based upon the evidence was discussed by the prosecution just yesterday, the evidence premised upon the documents, the testimony of people inside the corporation, and very, very specifically, testimony by people who have looked at the documents, financial experts examining all of this, talking about the transactions, talking about the core valuations that were at the center of this complaint, all of that mathematically coming up to $370 million in fraud that, again, the judge had previously found. And then also arguing yesterday that the judge not only impose that kind of financial assessment, but also that Donald Trump and his corporation be barred from future corporate activities there in the state of New York. Why? Because if the court finds, as it has, that fraud has existed, and indeed that there should be remedies for that, one of those, this is what the government argued, one of those should be basically disbarment from being kicked out, if you will, of the legitimate area of corporate entities in New York and being prohibited from the future involving real estate transactions and other things that the corporation itself does. That arguably, if Judge Engoron grants that portion of the request for some remedial response to all of this, if the judge grants that, that may in fact be a larger penalty than even the monetary amount itself is, because it would basically would stop the Trump Corporation and Donald Trump from doing what it has done for most of our natural lives, at least since Donald Trump and the corporation have been around in New York and in other places. Now, in the wake of whatever Judge Engoron does, and by the way, he has promised a decision by the end of this month, coming up quite soon. He probably has already begun to put together the outlines of his decision, but he will plainly codify, if you will, his findings in a written decision that will be issued. We will talk about it certainly on this Saturday morning broadcast, as will other broadcasts of Civic Media. The judge will issue a written opinion. And in the wake of that, two things will probably happen. One is that Donald Trump will appeal that to the appeals court, which is his right. And second, there will also be a request that that decision, whatever it is by Judge Engoron, be stayed, that it be limited while that appeal is going ahead. When we come back, I'll tell you a little bit more about the prospects for those things happening, and then move on to another civil case pending in New York, and some other criminal cases also pending in the courts of our nation. Stay with us for that important discussion.
Taking it to the street.
The Shaw, WAUK.
We all have someone we love, like the favorite lyric in our favorite song. You can't imagine life without them. Cancer screening tests can help keep the person you love around longer by detecting changes before cancer develops, or catch it early when it may be easier to treat. And many tests are available for free or covered by insurance. It's time to sound like a broken record. Tell all your friends and family, I love you. Get screened. Visit cancer.org/get screened to learn more.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
This is The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are back. We are talking now in this second segment of our second hour on our Saturday morning broadcast about cases pending in the United States of America, all of them once again in pursuit of the rule of law, justice, and also the effect of government prosecutions, civil and criminal, talking in particular about this major civil fraud case now coming to a conclusion in New York just in the past couple of days, with closing arguments having been presented by the prosecution, the state of New York, and also by the defense. The defense obviously arguing that the case should be dismissed, the prosecution maintaining before Judge Engoron that a judgment in the state's favor should be entered by him in this written order that he is going to be issuing, he has said, before the end of this month. And again, that order going to be a conclusion to the trial court proceedings. What happens in the wake of his issuing that decision? Well, almost certainly, Donald Trump, assuming that Judge Engoron imposes some significant penalty and may also impose the penalty of basically bringing the Trump Corporation to an end. If that happens, or even if something short of that happens, Donald Trump and his attorneys will appeal. There's an appeals court plainly in the state of New York. And that process, quite literally, through the appeals court, perhaps even to the highest court in the state of New York, will predictably take at least months, if not years, before this is ultimately all resolved. Now, along the way, Judge Engoron has another decision to make, and that is whether or not to stay, basically to take his opinion and not put it into effect while those appeals, while the challenges to his order are pending. And that's a decision that he is going to make based upon his view about the extent to which an appeal will be successful. Probably, predictably, this particular trial judge, who has been quite clear in his finding about fraud, and quite clear that with respect to this particular defendant, many of the things that he has done in his official capacity in charge of the Trump Corporation are things that run afoul of the New York laws. While he has said all of that, he has also, as I've indicated in the previous segment, given Donald Trump an awful lot of leeway when it comes to substance and even process in this trial. It is likely, if not completely predictable, that Judge Engoron may stay his decision, may say, you know what, you can go to the appeals court, have the appeals court review this very large omnibus decision that I am now rendering, and then, and only when, the entire appellate process is completed will it go into effect. Likely he will do that, but doesn't have to do that. If he decides that his opinion, his judgment, his decision will not be stayed, Donald Trump could also procedurally go to the appeals court and ask the appeals court to stay the lower court decision. A lot of process there, a lot of civics there, a lot of law school there, but all of that coming up in the wake of what is now approaching the conclusion of that major fraud trial that we've been talking about on this broadcast for quite literally, the entire time that we have been on the air. The appeals will follow with certainty. Another civil matter also going on in the state of New York coming up this coming week. This is in federal court, and we have heard about the plaintiff in this case, in this private, non-government case, civil case before. In addition to the four criminal indictments that we know about, Donald Trump is also facing, as I just indicated, this civil lawsuit, the civil fraud trial, and another civil case, among many others, candidly. This one is one in which writer E. Jean Carroll's second defamation case against the former president is proceeding apace. The district court judge, the federal district court judge, his name is Lewis Kaplan, is overseeing the case. You may recall that way back in October, we talked about a major decision that he rendered, about a 27-page decision, a pretrial order in this particular portion of what basically is a two-part defamation piece of litigation that E. Jean Carroll has pursued. All of this ultimately going back to her allegation, now proven in the first case, that during the course of an encounter with Donald Trump in a dressing room at a department store in the mid-1990s, he sexually assaulted her. Her allegations were both that that happened and also that he subsequently defamed her in connection with denying that that happened and making some other scurrilous comments about her. Judge Kaplan's order in the fall of the previous year made it abundantly clear that the case that's now going to go ahead this coming week, the second portion of this, if you will, is only going to get worse for Donald Trump in terms of the presentation. Now, why do I say that? Well, until recently, the former president's lawyers have been preparing plainly for this upcoming defamation trial, again, the federal court, almost as if the first one, again, finding that defamation happened. You may recall that that was also the case in which about a $5 million judgment was entered, almost as if that had never happened. And this is being seen, or was being seen, by the trial lawyers at the time as a second chance to sort of rewrite history in this particular matter and try once again to clear Donald Trump's name after a jury last year again concluded just the opposite, that he had in fact sexually assaulted E. Jean Carroll and that damages should follow. In the order, in the district court judge's order, Judge Kaplan wrote, the material facts concerning the alleged sexual assault against Carroll have already been determined. That's what the trial judge wrote. And this trial, the one coming up this coming week, he said, will not be a do-over, those are his words, not mine, will not be a do-over of the previous trial. This new jury, he said, will probably see some of the same evidence of misogyny from the Access Hollywood tape in which Donald Trump, as you all may regrettably recall, talked about grabbing people. The videotape deposition in which he remarks that stars get away with sexual assault, unfortunately or fortunately, all those kinds of things that Donald Trump said that were part of the initial trial also being presented here. The previous iteration of this case, along with those previous defamation denials by Donald Trump, also a part of the forthcoming trial this coming week. When we come back after this break, I'm going to tell you more about what we can anticipate in this second trial and then talk about other trials going ahead in the weeks and months ahead. Stay with us as we continue our discussion here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Brought
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Heavy snow, freezing rain, and brutally cold temperatures are affecting millions in the nation. Zach Taylor is at the National Weather Service.
We're in the midst of a wide-reaching coast-to-coast active winter weather pattern. Virtually every state under some sort of winter weather headline, ranging from blizzard warnings to winter storm warnings, as well as wind chill warnings and extreme cold. So several storm systems are impacting the United States, and that looks to continue at least through early next week.
Taiwan, voters have handed an unprecedented third term to the Democratic Progressive Party. CBS's Lucy Kraft.
The next president will be its current vice president, 64-year-old William Lai. Vilified by Beijing, Lai pledged to protect Taiwan from Chinese threats and intimidation.
More escalation in the Middle East after a new U.S. strike against Iran-backed Houthi militants who are vowing a strong response. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Packers' Keyshawn Nixon named to the All-Pro team. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Packers defensive back Keyshawn Nixon is in his second year of returning kickoffs and once again has been named to the AP's All-Pro first team. Matt LaFleur.
What an honor for everybody, because he can't do that alone. There's a lot of guys that are, you know, blocking for him, doing what they do, and so it's a credit to that whole unit, and certainly he's an incredible talent.
Keyshawn Nixon asked, what does it mean to be named the best kickoff returner in the league for a second consecutive year?
I think it's big for me and my accomplishment, but it's kudos to everybody. It always starts with the return unit, but for me, my accomplishment, they tell me some stat like the only people that ever go back-to-back was like Devin Hester and Cordell Patterson, so that's a hell of a group to be with.
The Packers take on the Cowboys in Dallas in the wild card playoffs Sunday. Has he ever returned one at AT&T Stadium?
I've never played in Dallas. It's going to be brand new for me.
That's the Packers kick returner, Keyshawn Nixon. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, snow and blowing snow. Winds continue to gust 30 to 35 out of the northwest. Temperatures fall throughout the day. Tonight, cloudy skies, single digits, wind chills down to 15 below zero. For Sunday, cloudy and cold, staying below zero with those wind chills.
It's 21 right now.
Robert Hack Diamonds pays cash for your unwanted gold, silver, and even diamonds. That's right. Robert Hack Diamonds wants to make you an offer on your gold, silver, and diamonds. The process is very simple. No appointment needed. Just come on in, sit down in a nice, relaxed atmosphere, and the staff of Robert Hack Diamonds will evaluate your unwanted gold, silver, and diamonds and make you an offer on the spot. Then you can decide if you want a deal or no deal. Robert Hack Diamonds can also convert your old jewelry into something new, or trade in your outdated pieces for something new and exciting. Many people inherit jewelry that might not be your taste, but you are sentimental. Why not have Robert Hack Diamonds take the golden gems and create something for you? So many options at Robert Hack Diamonds. Again, Robert Hack Diamonds pays cash for your unwanted gold, silver, and diamonds. See them in Brookfield just east of Moreland on Greenland Avenue, or 76 in Layton, right on the corner in Greenfield. RobertHackDiamonds.com.
Hi, I'm Emily from Weichert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Home ownership is a big deal, and so is taking the leap into the buying or selling of any property. The Weichert team gets that, and our job is to help you navigate the sales process and provide smooth sailing. You have questions? We have answers. You have worries? We have solutions. Let us open the door to your future home. Weichert Realtors Lake Point, 608-721-8002, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weichert-lakepoint.com.
There are 1,000 ways to say it.
Nope. Knock it off. Shut it down. Dream on. No dice. Give it a rest. Not a chance.
Or just
all text. You focus on the road.
As a passenger, you have the power to prevent an accident. There are 1,000 ways to stop a distracted driver. Choose one.
A message from CTIA.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
On The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Talking now about another civil trial going ahead next week in a federal district court in New York. This one being brought by E. Jean Carroll, once again alleging defamation by the former president. How does this one play out? It begins again next week. It deals with the denials Trump made as a United States president, with all the additional attention and gravitas that his former position of power bestowed upon him at the time that he made these comments. And in particular, this is the trial that is premised upon the claims that he made while he was the president of the United States of America, that the things that E. Jean Carroll had said about this sexual assault that happened in the Manhattan store back in the mid-1990s, that they were not true, that he never met this woman, as he said, and the denying that she had engaged with him at all, that he had engaged her at all, that any of this ever had happened. And so this time in this second trial, again beginning next week, much of the same information and evidence being presented, but once again focusing upon statements Donald Trump made while he was the president of the United States of America. And you may think, why is this now first coming forward? You may recall as well that there was a lot of litigation about whether or not Donald Trump's statements at the time that he was president, these allegedly defamatory statements against E. Jean Carroll, whether those things were again protected by his position as president. The Department of Justice, incredibly, for a long time had taken the position that indeed those things were things he said in the course and duties of his responsibilities, a position that I found ridiculous. The Department of Justice ultimately reversing its position and saying, no, indeed, those things a president says that are defamatory in connection with a private matter, plainly involving sexual assault in his past, those things are not a part of the duties and responsibilities of a president. Ultimately, the Department of Justice coming around, reversing its position, and effectively permitting this case to go forward, even though it is the second matter that parallels in many ways the previous case involving defamatory statements made by the president after he was in the Oval Office. A lot there to digest. The upshot of all this is that another trial underway, but the judge, while indicating that much of the evidence will be the same, this is not a do-over, as he indicated. Judge Kaplan plainly finding that the results of the previous trial, in which the findings about sexual assault and defamation already were found by a jury, will loom large in this trial as well. And again, why are we talking about that this morning? It focuses not only upon the process by which our federal and, yes, indeed, our state trial courts administer justice, the notion of filing a complaint, doing discovery, much of which, again, will be presented in the course of this trial, and ultimately having a day in court to present that evidence and having a trier of fact make determinations about what happened, in this case, sexual assault, and most specifically, focusing on defamation, a second trial based upon things that Donald Trump said during his presidency. Shades of that also having to do with this larger issue of immunity. As I said just a moment or so ago, the Department of Justice finding that the things that a president says that are not within the duties and scope of his responsibilities while being president are in fact subject to prosecution civilly. That's basically the finding in the E. Jean Carroll and other matters. Also the subject, as you well know, of the third case we're going to be talking about this morning, and that has to do with this major matter focusing upon whether a chief executive has immunity when it comes to the things that he, perhaps one day she, does while in the office of the presidency. Not exactly the same positions, not exactly the same theories as being presented, but very close in terms of the protections being granted or not being granted to a present or former president. I have spoken before at great length, and I'd like to think clearly about the notion that this argument that a chief executive, a president of the United States of America, is completely immune from civil, and in this case now, criminal prosecution is absurd. I've used the word ridiculous. I've used the word completely frivolous, and indeed it is. It is concerning to me and concerning to many other people that we are spending, candidly, so much time diverting the movement forward of the criminal case, the January 6th case being prosecuted by Jack Smith in the federal district court in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. That case right now, alleging in four counts against Donald Trump his involvement in the attempt to interfere with the 2020 election results. That case now being effectively suspended in terms of the trial date, in terms of other things going on, being suspended by virtue of wrestling with this immunity issue, which should not be difficult for any judge, a trial judge, an appellate court judge, a Supreme Court justice to wrestle with. The upshot is that a president, as Judge Chutkan wrote, is not a king. And if indeed any set of judges, the appeals court before this, for whom this matter is now pending, the Supreme Court before whom it could pend in the future, if any set of justices finds that indeed a president is immune in this case from criminal prosecution for the crimes that he or she one day has committed during the course of his presidency or her presidency, if a court should find that, our republic comes closer to the end. Then we do return to a time of kings and the supremacy of kings that we have discarded 240 years ago in this country. So what happened? What happened just this past week? Again, in a case in which Donald Trump actually appeared in court. We talked before about the fact that he appeared and actually spoke during the course of the oral arguments, the final arguments in the civil trial case in front of Judge Engoron, the fraud trial in the Manhattan State Court. He also appeared in the appeals court in the District of Columbia also just this past week. Now, in this particular case, he did not speak. And that's, again, the appropriate way for this to happen. On appeal, when you take up a decision made by a lower court judge, it is not a retrial. You don't have a chance to provide oral testimony. This is not a time for reintroduction of documents or the presentation of more oral words, commentary by witnesses. This is a time for truly argument by the judges, by the lawyers themselves, in front of the judges who question the lawyers about what happened at the lower court. Indeed, that's what happened just this past week. And so, a three-judge panel from the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., heard oral arguments just this past Tuesday on this issue of whether or not a president is immune from prosecution for the things that he does while in the presidency. It's a very significant case. In the completely outrageous and remote chance that the appeals court or ultimately the Supreme Court says that, yes, indeed, this immunity notion does have some legs. If that would happen, plainly, it would prevent the prosecution not only of the pending case involving the insurrection, the interference case being prosecuted in front of Judge Chutkan, but arguably also at least a portion of the case being presented in front of Judge Eileen Cannon in Florida as well. That's the documents case, the Mar-a-Lago documents case. So it has a huge impact not only upon the prosecutions going forward, but I would argue more importantly upon the future of our nation. Again, frustrated only because this very simple issue, which should not be taking the time of our trial, our appellate court judges, is in fact not only doing just that, but also arguably postponing the ultimate trial of Donald Trump on this singularly most important case of the four criminal cases that are pending against him. So let's talk about what happened in front of the appeals judges just this past week.
Again, they are the District of Columbia Circuit Court, 3-judge panel. Two of them, the judges' names are J. Michelle Childs and Judge Florence Y. Pan. Two of them very articulate in terms of doubting seriously the position being advanced by the defense and on behalf of Donald Trump. And the third judge, also Karen Henderson, likewise suggesting that she is not going to be buying into this notion generally, but for slightly different reasons. So let's kind of pull that apart. Let's begin with Karen Henderson in particular. What did she say during the course of the exchange, the oral argument that happened just this past Tuesday? Donald Trump present for it, but not speaking. His attorneys engaging in colloquy and conversation and disagreement, if you will, with the three judges, Childs and Pan and Henderson. Judge Henderson rejected this central portion of the Trump argument. What was that? That his efforts to overturn his loss to President Biden cannot be subject to prosecution because presidents, according to Donald Trump, have a constitutional duty to ensure that election laws are upheld. Now, the last portion of that, plainly, we could all agree with. But Judge Henderson was objecting to the first portion of that, that in the manner by which he was arguably ensuring that the election laws are advanced and enforced, he was engaging crimes. She said this in particular from the bench on Tuesday this week. She said, "I think it's paradoxical to say that his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed allows him to violate the criminal law." That was Judge Henderson speaking to Donald Trump's lawyers just this past week. She still, at the same time, expressed some worry around the edges that allowing the case to proceed, she said, could open the floodgates of prosecutions of former presidents. She raised the possibility of sending the case back to the federal district court, that again is Judge Tanya Chutkan, for some greater scrutiny, some greater review of all this, to consider the specifics of Donald Trump's actions. Now, highly likely, once again, that she is not buying into this notion of complete presidential immunity. Significantly, that when it comes to the deciding factor, we heard from two other judges, and again, they are Judges Childs and Judge Pan, both of them rejecting virtually outright the core of the position being articulated by Donald Trump and his attorney. Judge Pan, in particular, asked the attorney for Donald Trump to address a series of very interesting hypotheticals, and they were plainly intended to test the limits of this position that presidents have absolute immunity from criminal prosecution when they engage in official acts. And in particular, the allegation was, the position was, by the defense, that before the government can charge a president, a former president, with criminal prosecution, that president must first have been impeached and convicted by the Senate for the same basic facts, the same matter. Again, none of that in the Constitution, a brand new concept articulated by the defense attorneys in recent times, and again on Tuesday before the judge. Judge Pan and the other two judges as well. Among these hypotheticals that Judge Pan asked counsel for Donald Trump, she said this: what if a president ordered SEAL Team 6, again the SEALs, these Navy commando units, she said, what if the president were to order the assassination of the president's political rival? Can he do that? Could she do that and be completely immune from prosecution? And the counsel for Donald Trump responded that such a president would surely be impeached and convicted, but he insisted that courts would not have jurisdiction, would not be able to prosecute over that kind of a murder trial unless that impeachment and that conviction first happened. Again, ridiculous in terms of its presentation in court, even as they're articulated out loud right now on this broadcast. When we come back, I'll tell you more about what happened during the course of this important oral argument before the 3-judge panel of the District Court of Columbia, and predict with certainty how it is that they're going to resolve this very straightforward issue about whether or not presidents are immune from criminal prosecution for their acts in office. Come back right after this break and hear more about this oral argument.
Thank you. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
What's your go-to when the cold winds of winter blow? A heavy coat? A hat? For many of us, it's lip stuff, too. But did you know one of the most popular brands, Carmex, the one in the little yellow tube or tub, is a Wisconsin product? It's made in Franklin, a suburb of Milwaukee, and it's shipped to more than 60 countries every year. So can you guess the original use for Carmex? Fixing squeaky doors, actual lip balm, or to soften baseball gloves? The answer coming up. Alfred Woolwing created Carmex in the kitchen of his Dodge County home in Rubicon in 1937. He hand-poured thousands of jars until deciding to automate the manufacturing process in the 70s. Now, can you guess the original use for Carmex when it was created more than 80 years ago? It's always been meant to be a lip balm, but people use it on other dry or itchy skin areas too. It remains a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Back and talking about this all-important oral argument before the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit happening just this past week, Judge Pan expressing great doubt about this notion that a president has complete immunity for the things that he or she does. The prosecution, of course, also has an opportunity, as they took up during the course of this oral argument this past week, and argued, of course, that the hypothetical president who uses a SEAL team to try to kill a rival and then escapes criminal liability for it would be outrageous. And in particular, suggesting that that's an extraordinarily frightening future. A frightening future is the way that the counsel, again in Jack Smith's office, described the position being articulated by Donald Trump and his attorneys. He also said this. He said, frankly, if these kinds of fact patterns being advanced by the defense, that is on behalf of Donald Trump, arise again, I think it would be awfully scary if there weren't some sort of mechanism by which to reach that criminally. In other words, there can be no basis. There can be no basis for saying that a president is above the law, and for that reason that this immunity doctrine being advanced by Donald Trump and his attorneys have some weight. The judges, again, also indicated that during the course of Donald Trump's second impeachment trial, again, making reference to the argument being made by the defense attorneys, during his impeachment trial, his second impeachment trial, his attorneys at that time said that the Senate cannot find him guilty. Why? Because it's only in a criminal prosecution brought by the Department of Justice that a president like Donald Trump could be held responsible for his acts in office. And so basically, completely contradicting what the attorneys have said before the Court of Appeals way back when, a long time ago, when the second impeachment proceeding was going forward, the trial before the Senate, his attorneys said just the opposite, that you should not impeach, you cannot find guilty based upon the articles of impeachment, because the only remedy that's available is criminal prosecution. Now saying that criminal prosecution is not available because the only remedy, at least the predicate remedy, is impeachment. That also brought out by the two judges, Judge Pan and also Judge Childs, noting the inconsistency in all of that. Now, the judges plainly, I've got before them now, in the wake of that oral argument, a decision to make. Hopeful that they will make that decision, a written order forthcoming fairly quickly. It can, from my perspective, be the kind of thing that could be decided in the course of about two or three sentences, candidly, making reference to the Nixon case, other fundamental principles out there, making reference to what Judge Chutkan has said already, which is presidents are not kings, and the consequences of finding just the opposite, catastrophic for our nation. So let's assume rightfully that the Court of Appeals issues this opinion and says that Donald Trump's position is not meritorious, that he is not immune. He will plainly seek review by the United States Supreme Court. And we should hope that the Supreme Court, looking at the frivolity of this argument, would say, you know what, we're not even going to review this. We're not going to grant certiorari as to this. And therefore, we're going to deny a further appeal on this. We're going to let the Court of Appeals decision rejecting the presidential immunity concept, we're going to let that stand. And based upon that, then everything goes back to Judge Chutkan, and she can then proceed with her trial, having gone through this diversion, if you will, for a number of weeks, arguably months, while this silly, frivolous immunity position is advanced. The Supreme Court could, in fact, take this case, which would further delay all of this. They could undertake to have briefing done. They could also undertake oral argument down the road. But again, I would offer that this is one of those times when the Supreme Court has got to resolve this in one way or another quickly. The most efficient way of doing that would be to deny even a appeal going forward, which it can do, and bring this back into the realm of the trial court. Let Judge Chutkan go ahead with the trial. Let Jack Smith go ahead with his prosecution as soon as possible on those all-important counts still pending. And that leads me to the final comments of our hour, and that is the Supreme Court. And we've talked before, as we will in the future, about the heavy docket. We know that in just the past week, on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, the court was looking at cases involving everything from immigration cases to no-fly lists to the grants of quarterly fees in Chapter 11 bankruptcy cases. In the coming week, it's got 2 days of oral argument coming up on Tuesday and on Wednesday, having to do with some securities issues, the taking clause of the Fifth Amendment, but most importantly, on the 17th, on Wednesday, this coming week, the court undertaking this major case called Relentless or Raimondo, actually two cases, determining whether this thing called Chevron deference will last, whether or not the notion of federal judges deferring to the experts in agencies when the law prescribed by the Congress may be ambiguous or unclear. A major case, again, I would argue, even in the midst of these cases having to do with guns and social media, even the Trump cases, this case called Raimondo or Relentless, I would argue one of the most significant cases for the future of democracy. That's coming up for oral argument this coming Wednesday, the 17th, and having to do with whether or not the Chevron defense, the Chevron deference, the Chevron concept, which has been out there for decades, should in fact be rescinded and turned back in such a way that the federal courts should no longer rely upon the expertise of the people inside our agencies who know what they're doing. I want to talk more about that oral argument in our next broadcast, and that leads me to invite you to return to us next week, next Saturday morning, for more discussion of the rule of law, the operation of government, and the aspiration for justice in our nation and beyond. I thank you for joining me this morning, and I wish you a good week in support of all the good things that America's about as together we attempt to pursue justice in every way in our lives and our livelihoods. Have a good week, everybody.
Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained.
This is The Shaw,
540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it. Navigating without a compass, eyes waiting, started to wonder, metamorphosis, philosopher you thought you is.
When your kid can't find the language, help them find the lyrics.
Listen to the Sound It Out album and get tips and tools to start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.